Today is May 21st. We're going to go out of order a little bit today. The first item we're going to hear today is Senate Bill 373A. Open a public hearing on Senate Bill 373A. Council?
Members, Senate Bill 373A comes from the Judicial Department and is a response to a Court of Appeals case in which an employer withheld child support wages but did not promptly pay those wages to the Support Enforcement Division. The plaintiff is here to testify. He suffered considerable damages, but the Court of Appeals found the statute did not cover that situation. So what this bill does is it makes an employer liable to both parents when the employer fails to pay to the Support Enforcement Division in a timely manner any wages withheld as a result of the order. It restates the current law that the employer is liable for failing to withhold and for withholding too much. It also changes the remedies for all three types of withholding violations.
Okay. Brett Arvidson, Emily Kinzer, and Ronell Shankle, please.
We're always out of order. I know.
But thank you. You're nice. And just for
thank
that.
You. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Emily Kinzer. I serve as staff to State Senator Suzanne Bonamici, representing District 17. The idea for this bill came to Senator Bonamici through Brett Arvidson, a constituent of hers who is here today. And we want to make sure he tells his story in his own words. But I want to say that the passage of Senate Bill 373 is important for all non-custodial Oregon parents who are doing the best to provide for their children. Brett Arvidson is a responsible, hardworking parent who is dedicated to his daughter. When Brett's employer withheld his child support payments from his paycheck, but, admitting a cash flow problem, failed to send them to his daughter on time for several months, Brett was held liable under Oregon's strict punishments for non-custodial parents who fail to pay child support. However, it was Brett's employer who was failing to pay. Senate Bill 373 ensures that responsible parents have recourse if their employer or another entity that is obligated to withhold and send child support on their behalf fails to do so. The bill ensures this recourse in the following ways. First, it clarifies that any person or entity served with an order to withhold child support payments is responsible for any damages suffered by the child or parent as a result of failure to pay as ordered. Second, it clarifies that noncompliance includes withholding amounts in excess of the amount specified in the withholding order, failure to pay within the time limit specified in the order, or failure to withhold in any other way. In 2007, the legislature passed House Bill 2674, requiring that child support payments be sent to children within a specified time period. This bill clarifies that employers are responsible for timely payment, just as non-custodial parents are. Further, the bill allows the Division of Child Support to initiate an action on behalf of the child or the parent to recover the amounts and any additional damages suffered and to recover attorney's fees if they prevail. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, it is critical that if responsible parents like Brett Arvidson have their credit damaged, passports revoked, or professional licenses threatened, those parents are entitled to recover their damages. I hope that you will support good parents in their efforts to raise their children and join Senator Bonamici, the entire Senate Judiciary Committee, and 25 members of the Senate, with four excused, in voting for this bill. Thank you, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Ronell, do you want to go next?
Sure. Okay. Members of the committee, good afternoon. For the record, Ronell Shankle with the Attorney General's Office here in support of Senate Bill 373. Emily did a good job of describing what the bill does. I've talked with many of you about the child support programming and how this works, so I won't repeat any of that other than to say and remind you that actually when this came to the attention of the Department of Justice during the interim and we found out there was this significant loophole in the law, we were looking at drafting very similar legislation. And we agree that this needs to be fixed, and it is an important thing to be fixed for the customers of the child support program and the citizens of Oregon. I think I'll just leave it at that. Unless you have any questions, I'm happy to address those.
Please go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Brett Arvidson. I live at 12340 Southwest Faircrest. That's Portland, 97225. I support Senate Bill 373A for protecting innocent non-custodial parents from injustice and expediting critical child support for Oregon's children. I hope my story illustrates how the employers exploit the payroll deduction system, damaging families. In 2001, I started working for an engineering company called Kurahashi & Associates. Routinely, the Washington County District Attorney issued a wage withholding order, and Kurahashi began deducting my daughter's child support from my paycheck. Shortly thereafter, I received a notice from the District Attorney indicating my account was seriously in arrears and threatening enforcement action. I originally thought it was a mistake and immediately sent a letter to the DA saying with the pay stubs and showed that I was actually owed an $80 refund. Then I received a rather memorable call from the district attorney. Evidently, Kurahashi was keeping the deducted amounts. When I suggested they contact Mr. Kurahashi about the arrearage, she told me that it was state policy not to enforce legal orders against employers. They would continue action against me. When I demanded a hearing, she informed me that I could not contest an enforcement action. I then met with Greg Kurahashi and gave him a letter describing the impacts of this activity to my family. I asked him to stop. Greg gave me some vague promises, but argued that the order was an issue between the state and Kurahashi. Eventually, the arrearage was paid, but the next payment was a month late. During my tenure at Kurahashi, he kept 64IA two payments. They were 1 to 4 months late. In one instance, the Child Support Division received 7 payments on the same day. During that period, the state destroyed my credit rating, charged me enforcement fees, seized a tax return, allowed the IRS to reduce my exemptions, threatened to garnish my bank accounts, and threatened to revoke my professional engineer's license. The most painful memory involves my mother, my daughter, and my stepdaughter interrogating me about the arrearage. I felt alienated from my family and punished for my hard work. Throughout this period, I kept calling the DA and sending letters with pay stubs demanding action against Kurahashi. They continued to refuse to acknowledge the order. I kept confronting Kurahashi. They repeatedly said it's perfectly legal. If you think I'm exaggerating, I have attached an Oregonian article, and he said basically the same thing to the Oregonian. After leaving Kurahashi, I spent several months in circuit court and tax court resolving these issues. This round of litigation cost me thousands of dollars. Then I actually read the language of my wage withholding order in ORS 25-424. It said the holder of support rights, the obligor, the child support division, or a district attorney may bring action against the withholder. Based on these plain words of the statute, I initiated action against Kurahashi. We became the first case of first impression, the only case of record for ORS 25-424. The state of Oregon has never enforced a single wage withholding order. And the DHA reported there are over 1,000 employers known to abuse child support funds. We pursued litigation in Circuit Court, the Court of Appeals, and before the Oregon Supreme Court. The DOJ submitted an amicus brief defending Kurahashi & Associates during my Supreme Court petition. Sadly, the appeals court overruled the plain language of the statute. Senate Bill 373A addresses punishment of innocent parents, provides legal recourse, sends a message that exploiting or taking child support funds will not be tolerated. Paragraphs 2 and 3 benefit both custodial and non-custodial parents to ensure their children get the support they need. In light of the demonstrated refusal to defend our children, the legislature must provide both parents with the right to act. Paragraph 3D, which provides the next innocent parent in my situation, a recourse when the employer refuses to withhold or pay as required. Non-custodial parent earns the wages, maintains liability for the debt, and has their moral right to defend their children. The damage liability in paragraph 3D includes recovery of exploited funds that can be forwarded to the Child Support Division for satisfaction of arrears or refunded to the damaged parent. Paragraph 4 allows the Child Support Division and or a district attorney to bring action on behalf of either parent. I sincerely hope that the obligor will never need to use paragraph 3D. I hope the agency issuing a wage order will enforce the wage order that benefits hundreds of thousands of Oregon children. Quick action by the responsible agency prevents a small problem from becoming a large problem. Getting divorced is not a criminal conviction. The law requires over 250,000 non-custodial parents to mandatory enroll in the wage withholding system without any payment history at all. Payroll deduction accounts for 2/3 of child support of $225 million per year. Most non-custodial parents work hard for their children and deserve the benefit of the doubt. Child support arrears do exist in this country, but mostly result from poverty, not child abandonment. Recent federal studies show that 80% of child support belongs to people with $15,000 a year or less in income. States virtually collect all arrears from parents with more than $20,000 a year in annual income. I ask this House Judiciary Committee to make the right decision for Oregon's children and pass Senate Bill 373A. Thank you.
Any questions? Thank you, panel.
Yes.
All right. Just to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 373 and open a work hearing on Senate Bill 373.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Wisnant.
I recommend Senate Bill 373 as amended to the floor of a due pass recommendation.
Representative Wisnant moves Senate Bill 373 as amended to the floor with a due pass. Is there any discussion? Call the roll, please.
Representative Barton.
Aye.
Representative Cameron.
Aye.
Representative Garrett.
Aye.
Representative Krieger.
Representative Olson.
Aye.
Representative Shields.
Aye.
Representative Smith.
Aye.
Vice Chair
Stegler.
Aye.
Vice Chair Wisnant.
Aye.
Chair Barker.
Aye. Motion carries. Would somebody like to carry that? Representative Shields, please. Thank you. Committee stand at ease for a few. Oh, never mind. Back in session.
Senate Bill 314.
I haven't opened yet.
No? Sorry.
Okay. Open a public hearing on Senate Bill 314. Council, please. Oh, I'm sorry. Open a work session.
Senate Bill 314, we first heard back on the 5th of May. It requires a driver to report to law enforcement immediately an accident involving injury or death. It requires a driver to report immediately an accident resulting in property damage in excess of $1,500. At the time, there were some issues with one of the definitions, and I believe it had to do with reporting to an officer as opposed to a law enforcement agency. We have the Dash 3 amendments in front of the members. These are from Senator Krasanski's office, and they broaden the definition so that at the time of an accident, you have to report immediately to a police officer or a law enforcement agency by the quickest means available. And they define law enforcement agency broadly to mean any agency that employs members of the Oregon State Police, sheriff, deputy sheriff, city police officer, or a law enforcement officer employed by a service district.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Wisnant.
I move the Dash 3s in the Senate Bill 314.
Representative Wisnant moves the Dash 3 amendments in the Senate Bill 314. Representative Wisnant moves the Dash 3s. Is there any objection?
Mr. Chair, I'm struggling with this bill, mainly because of what we've done over the last several years from the legislative body for structure of reporting for injury, serious injury crashes, as well as just crashes themselves for value amount and fatalities. This one here, I don't know how. The question was asked as to where are we in comparison to the rest of the country with other states, and I don't know. But I do know that that was one of the issues that we were trying to do years ago to be similar to what other states are doing. So if I'm a motorist coming in visiting from another state and all of a sudden I have a serious injury and I'm not aware, I have a problem, you know, I'm not going to know, and I could very easily be in violation of this statute or this bill anyways. So I'm just to let you know, I'm struggling with this bill.
Okay. Hearing no objections to the Dash 3 amendments, so adopted. We don't have a fiscal yet, so we will not be moving the bill today.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Wisnant.
Does council know that there was a lot of people voted for it in the Senate? Was that because of the reporting to the Department of Transportation, and we've now got law enforcement involved? Is that the...
I have no information at this time about the basis for the no votes. I can find that out, though, between now and the time we work this initially, if you'd like.
Very appreciate that. Thank you. So now I'm waiting for Bill?
Yeah, I'll go grab it.
Okay. Committee, stand at ease for a few minutes while waiting for it. We will carry Senate Bill 314 over to Tuesday. Thank you. And we're at ease. Today was a work session or
public hearing.
Public hearing on Senate Bill 309A.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 309A comes to you from the Senate Interim Judiciary Committee. It has two separate issues in the bill. The first issue relates to the hearsay, and it allows, in this addressing a particular case in the Oregon Supreme Court, it's a situation where you have a individual, a defendant, say, who makes a statement, person does not speak English, he makes it to an interpreter. The interpreter then relays the information, what the person said, to the police officer. Later, the interpreter is not available. It goes to the issue of the admissibility of that evidence. By this bill, that evidence would be admissible. The second part of the bill, starting over in page 2, relates to custodial interviews conducted by law enforcement agency in a law enforcement facility shall be electronically recorded if the interview is conducted in connection with an investigation into a person felony. Now, Mr. Chairman of the committee, I understand there will be an amendment to limit that further to Measure 11 crimes. It exempts certain situations. It does not apply to a grand jury, statement made in record in open court, custodial interview conducted in another state in compliance with the laws of that state, a custodial interview conducted by federal law enforcement officer in compliance with federal law, a statement that was spontaneously volunteered and did not result from a custodial interview, a statement made during the arrest proceeding in response to a routine question, a custodial interview in which the state demonstrates good cause for failure to electronically record, or finally, a law enforcement agency that employs five or fewer police or reserve officers. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, that was intended to address the issue of small police departments that may have difficulty in obtaining recordation devices. Then he talks about what happens if a statement is not recorded and meets those conditions. Then the particular issue, the penalty, would be a jury instruction during the trial. In the bottom of page 3, it defines what a custodial interview means. A questioning by a law enforcement officer that requires the officer to advise the person being interviewed of the person's constitutional rights. I think every police officer and every citizen in the country from watching TV understands that. Good cause includes situation where the defendant refused to have custodial interview electronically recorded, or the failure to electronically record the custodial interview was a result of equipment failure and the replacement device was not immediately available, or the law enforcement officer operating the equipment believed in good faith that the equipment was operating properly. Chairman of the committee, it also defines law enforcement facility means a courthouse building or premises that is a place of operation for a municipal police department, county sheriff's office, or other law enforcement agency. And I'm over in page 4, Mr. Chairman of the committee, in which persons may be detained in connection with juvenile delinquency proceeding or criminal charge. As chairman of the committee, that would not include a statement made in the police car. It would not include a statement made outside a parking lot or something like that. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, if you go to the last page, you'll come to the applicability provision. This will apply. Now, I think this may change as a result of some proposed amendments, but it would apply to, upon the effective date, to a minor or non-native speaking English person or a person charged, I believe, with 163 I was going to say murder, but not sure of that. And then as it relates to the other provisions, it would only apply until July 1, 2011. But as I said, I believe there's an amendment that the parties have worked out that would change that.
Okay, thank you. And we will just be hearing this today. We will not be working it. First, I'd like to call up Gail Meyer, Larry Matizar, Wendell Berklin. Do you want me to get him on the phone?
That'd be great.
Okay. Jeff Reese, this is the State Representative Jeff Barker out in Salem, Oregon, and we have you on the speakerphone. We just are opening the hearing on our Senate Bill 309, and I will have Gail Meyer from the OCDLA, the Oregon defense lawyers, start off, and so you can listen in, and we'll have you speak at appropriate time. Thank you.
Thank you.
Ms. Meyer, please.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair Barker, members of the committee. It's a pleasure to be here this afternoon on behalf of Senate Bill 309. I'm Gail Meyer on behalf of the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. This is a bill that would require, it would create a shift in practice amongst law enforcement. It would require them to electronically record the entirety of their interrogations of a suspect or accused when they are in a law enforcement facility. This bill that's before you has been worked through many amendments over on the Senate side. OCDLA's intent has been to listen to law enforcement's concerns about the bill. It does constitute a shift in their practice. And when we have had an articulated concern expressed to us that the bill in its form would impede their ability to get a good statement, we've adjusted our bill accordingly. In the last 18 hours, there has been substantial movement in agreements and amendments. Mr. Michael Schrunk, who's the Multnomah County District Attorney, has faxed a letter to Chair Barker and others indicating his support of the bill in principle and recommended some amendments and some changes. I, on behalf of OCDLA, then met with John Bradley, who is their chief deputy below Mr. Schrunk, and we agreed to amended language yesterday morning. And then subsequent to that, Multnomah County spoke with Kevin Neely on behalf of the Oregon District Attorneys Association, and Mr. Neely then agreed. I believe that's what's been passed out to you. What the members should have before you is a hand-engrossed version. And what I would like to do is go through that, and it will show you the amendments that have occurred within the last 18 hours. So this is clearly not something that came from Ledge Council. It's something that I hand-engrossed myself. Let me do say that these amendments and changes in language, because they've occurred in the last 18 hours, there are many stakeholders to this bill that have not been able to catch up to speed. This happened very quickly as a result of Mr. Schrunk's letter. So while the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers, the Multnomah County DAs, and the Oregon District Attorneys Association have agreement on these amended language changes, it has left some people in the dust who haven't had the opportunity to quickly get back up to speed. So I will let the law enforcement community speak for itself, but I know many of them have not been able to get their positions known yet. With respect to this hand-engrossed bill, does everyone know what I'm talking about? Okay. As to the interpreter provision, it kicks in on page 2. And I will let the district attorney's office talk about the interpreter provision, but that's the small I in the middle of the page. The provisions relating to the recording starts in the middle of page 2 under section 2. The biggest shift that's occurred now as a result of the discussions in the last 18 hours is we've shifted the crimes that the bill will ultimately apply to. As passed out of the Senate, the bill applied to person felonies. Thanks. Oh, I see. Is it just being passed out now? No. Okay. As originally written and came out of the Senate, the bill was to apply to person felonies. We've now agreed that it will only be applicable to Measure 11 crimes and to aggravated murders. So that's one of the biggest shifts. We've narrowed the class of crimes that the bill will apply to.
Thank you.
We've added a new, and I'm looking now at the bottom of page two here, we've added a new small section I. This was at the request of the Oregon State Police. We wanted to make it very, very clear that correctional staff in a facility is not covered by the bill. So if you have a crime that occurs in the prisons or in a jail, and you have correctional staff that has to separate the melee, and then they have to ask questions. By law, these individuals are in custody, and we do not intend to pick that up. So if correctional staff is handling an instance on the inside of a facility, and it's in the performance of their duties of treatment, custody, and control or supervision of individuals, the bill does not apply to them. We're talking about law enforcement investigating crime. So if later Oregon State Police were to come in for the purpose of investigating that case, they would be covered by the bill, but correctional staff is expressly here excluded. Section 3 of the bill, which starts at the bottom of page 2 and goes over to the top of page 3, had previously been one of its more contentious provisions, and that relates to the remedy for failure to record. As the bill reads, if the state offers an unrecorded statement made under circumstances when there was a duty to record, and the state is unable to demonstrate by a preponderance of evidence that an exception applies, then, upon request of the defendant, the court shall instruct the jury regarding the legal requirement to record and the superior reliability of electronic recordings when compared with testimony about what was said and done. What I'd like to tell the committee is that there's 15 states now that do require recording. Actually, 16. Montana just passed a bill this session. And there's different gradations of remedy in those bills. In some states, they exclude the statement. They say, if you're supposed to record and you don't, the statement stays out. The middle tier basically has a presumption of some sort. It's a presumption of exclusion, or it's a presumption of involuntariness or lack of truthfulness. And then your less calibrated remedy is the cautionary jury instruction. Our intent here was to simply be non-judgmental in our language, but to simply state the obvious. There was a duty to record. Consider the superior reliability of electronic recordings over testimony as to what was said and done. Now, in practical effect, what will happen is the Oregon Uniform Criminal Jury Instruction Committee will graft a uniform jury instruction that would handle this provision. One of the amendments that came in within the last 18 hours was to state expressly what remedies are not allowed. So it says the court shall not exclude the defendant's statement or dismiss criminal charges as a result of a violation of this act. So in no instance would a court exclude a statement or dismiss a criminal case because of the act. And I might just pass in reference, we all know this, but Ledge Council is going to take our language and do what they do with it, but this is the language that we agreed to. Okay. We added a new subsection 4, also at the request of Multnomah County DA, and this is to state this. Currently, because there's no obligation to record, there is a uniform jury trial instruction that, quite frankly, the district attorneys don't like. It's cumbersome. It says, you know, the police officer-related statements made by the defendant, jury, when you consider those statements, figure out, did he get it right? Did he remember accurately what the defendant said? Did he misinterpret what the defendant said? Did he intentionally alter or convey, you know, change the meaning of what the defendant said? The district attorneys don't like that jury instruction. So this is, the new section 4 is an attempt to motivate everyone to get the defendant's statements recorded. So if the state offers only recorded statements of the defendant, then the court shall give no cautionary jury instruction regarding the content of the defendant's statement. So if the defendant makes a statement in the field, the bill doesn't apply. If he makes statements in the police car, the bill doesn't apply. If they come back to the law enforcement facility, there's custodial interrogation, the bill does apply. If they can get the defendant to repeat those words and put it on a recorded statement, and then the only evidence the government offers at trial is on the recorded statement, then the bill says there's no cautionary jury instruction at all regarding the content of the statement. So we hope that that would be a motivator for them to get everything recorded. Okay. Section 5 relates to discovery. The bill provided that electronic copies of the recorded statement is compliance with discovery. We've put in here a new provision. This was at the request of the Oregon State Police. Unless the court orders otherwise, the defendant's attorney may not copy, disseminate, or republish the electronic copy of the custodial interview, except to provide a copy to an agent of the defendant's attorney for the limited purpose of case preparation. Sometimes in some other states, apparently what's happened, some of these interviews have ended up on YouTube. Nobody really needs that. So this would prevent the defense attorney from further disseminating the electronic copy provided through discovery. Changes in 6 and 7 were really just tightening things up. I don't know that I need to really talk about them. Okay, at the bottom of the page with respect to good cause exceptions relating to equipment failure, we've expanded it. We wanted to make sure that there was a good cause exception, not only for equipment failure, but for user failure. So if you look over to page 4, we've added a new subsection I. It's a good cause exception if the peace officer believed in good faith that the officer had properly operated the equipment and that the equipment was recording the statement. So we make it really crystal clear, I think. We're not just talking about the equipment not working, but we're talking about the user making a mistake, thinking the equipment was recording when, in fact, the equipment wasn't. Then, biggest second change is on the back page, the implementation date. The bill that passed out of the Senate had a phase-in, two phases. First phase was going to kick in to homicides, minors, and non-native speakers. And then second phase was to be all-person felonies. Multnomah County and OCDLA just kind of thought there might be greater beauty and simplicity, collapsed it into one phase, effective July 1, 2010. One thing we've learned through the process here is that everybody acknowledges that this is a best practice. DAs acknowledge it. Law enforcement acknowledge it. Courts acknowledge it. That's why some of the Supreme Courts in other states have required this to happen. We have had testimony in the Senate side from the Chief Justice. Chief Justice Paul DeMunis testified before the Senate that this promotes judicial efficiencies. He says if we can have a recorded statement, it can spare us a three-day hearing. We think it will reduce the number of pretrial motions to suppress, and it will streamline the process. And so I'd like to pass around the Chief Justice's testimony. And then we also have written testimony here from Rebecca Brown. She is a policy analyst with the Innocence Project in New York. The Innocence Project is the organization that has been doing the exonerations with exonerees through DNA testing. They have found that a quarter of their cases have false confessions. And so one of their promoted reforms is to make sure that confessions, the entirety of the interrogation process is in fact recorded. So I thank you. I can take questions, but otherwise we thought we might get testimony at this point from Lieutenant Jonathan Priest. He is on the telephone. Lieutenant Priest is a lieutenant with the Denver Police Department. Denver PD has been voluntarily recording the entirety of their custodial interrogation since 1983. Lieutenant Priest tells me he was with the Bureau prior to the change, so he knows the before and the after. And I would like to suggest that perhaps we get his comments now.
Okay, thank you, Ms. Meyer. Lieutenant Priest, why don't you go ahead and speak? We have the speakerphone on.
Okay. Can you hear me okay?
We can hear you very loud and clear. Thank you.
Excellent. How would you like me to start, sir?
Just, you go ahead and just give the background that you spoke with Ms. Meyer about.
Well, my name is Jonathan Priest, and first of all, I'd like to thank everyone for allowing me the time to speak today. We have, at the Denver Police Department, been video interviewing since November of 1983. The main thrust of what we were trying to do initially was a better way of capturing interviews related to primarily officer-involved shootings. That almost immediately segued into a way of better capturing interviews related to our homicide and very critical criminal investigations. That continued for a number of years to where many other investigators within our Crimes Against Persons Bureau, as well as our property crimes detectives began to realize that this was a better way to capture interviews of suspects, of our victims, and certainly our witnesses to any of our crimes. We began seeing a fairly large increase in the use of what was at that time a single interview room utilizing VHS technology. Within probably 10 years of our initial video project, we saw a need to actually increase the size of our rooms, and we went by doubling the size, quadrupling the size, and now we have 8 rooms available to us here at our headquarters building. There are 2 rooms each in 3 of our outlying districts. We use video technology in our Family Crisis Center for our child abuse interviews, and also at our Child Advocacy Center for our forensic interviews, also with children. One of the, the main benefits that we are seeing with this is complete documentation of our interviews from start to finish. We don't use what some have called the pre-interview tactic, and then getting the highlights of the interview on video. We do complete interviews from start to finish, regardless if we're talking to a witness, a victim, or a suspect. Oftentimes we just call it the Miranda to conclusion interviewing. We are not mandated to do this. We have done this voluntarily since November of 83. Today, with our police department, it's rare that I would find a detective that knew a police department that didn't have video interviewing. We have people who wait in line to use the video rooms rather than do an interview without video, even though there's no requirement that they do a video interview. It is just our best practices to have that done. It has been highly successful for us. We have benefited greatly when we get into a trial setting. Defense attorneys will usually ask more questions when we have a situation where a video interview was not done in a particular case. The detectives have realized that it is much easier to testify in court about the videos that they have done rather than explain why they didn't do one. The courts have seen a great benefit in our utilization of our video interviews, and our prosecutors swear by them. We have done this voluntarily since 1983. The majority of the major police departments in the state of Colorado also voluntarily do video interviewing. I have spoke on a national level to other police departments through the IACP and also through traveling to various states and other groups to talk about the benefits of video interviewing and how that will enhance investigations for law enforcement. What I have experienced as a result of that is that once a department makes the change from interviewing without video or electronic documentation to one where they utilize that on a regular basis, that department would never go back to doing it the old way. This is just the best practices of where we are going in law enforcement with respect to capturing statements from people involved in criminal incidents. One of the things I talk about when I do my trainings is specifically that this is a train that left the station. This is on down the tracks, and now those people who are not utilizing this technology have to catch up to it. This isn't something that is going to come. It has come. And we now, as a law enforcement group, need to get on board with this and move forward with it.
May I pose a question?
Yes, you may.
Thank you.
Please.
Lieutenant Priest Gilmeyer again. I just want to point out for the committee one aspect of our bill, and that it does not require video recording. It could be, it's electronic in any form, so it could just simply be audio. But Lieutenant Priest, could you talk about startup costs and what sort of equipment is really necessary in order to pull this off? And I also might point out to the committee that one thing the bill does do is that it changes the law in Oregon and allows for an exception to the two-party consent requirement so that if right now we are a two-party consent state, if two people are talking in person, neither can surreptitiously record the other, our bill would make an exception to that rule for purposes of being in the facility and doing an interview pursuant to the act. So we do enact in the bill a one-party consent allowance, so it would allow law enforcement to surreptitiously record an individual while they are in the facility. But so, Lieutenant, if you could address perhaps some of the startup costs and the equipment that you need to pull this off, and then secondly, whether you need the one-party consent in order to do it well.
Well, the startup costs for this are relatively minimal. I mean, you can actually have a video interview room with a small video camera and a tripod, or if you even wanted to eliminate the tripod, you could do it with a box. So it's something that is relatively simple to do. So for, you know, cost less than $400, you could have a video interview facility. There are two areas that I get pushback from when I'm talking about the benefits of video interviewing. The number one pushback is the suspect will never talk to us again. Now, that's the same argument they had when Miranda came out in June of 1966, is that because we have to advise somebody of their rights, they'll never talk to us. Well, Jack Webb showed us that that's not the case. I mean, we're able to show time and time again that after advising somebody of their rights, they continue to talk to us and continue to confess. So that argument doesn't hold water. One of the things that we do on a regular basis is when we start our video interviews, we tell people that they're being videotaped from the get-go. Now, granted, because we have been doing this for a long time, we have some fairly nice state-of-the-art rooms, and we can spend a lot of money on them. However, that said, you can have a fairly easy startup situation for next to nothing. Even when we have detectives who go out into the field and do video interviews, I have handheld video cameras and small tripods that they take with them when they go out in the field and do those interviews. So even when they're away from the building, they're able to do videotaped interviews wherever it is they need to go, a hospital, someone's home, or even another town or jurisdiction where they don't have a video interview facility. So the startup costs are very, very nominal. With respect to the two-party consent, Colorado is a single consent state. I do not have to tell the people they're being recorded, but we do. We do it routinely. It's part of our protocol. But when you have a two-party consent situation, if somebody refuses to talk to you, well, I guess then you're turning your video off. But I can tell you from personal experience, I have never one time had anybody refuse to talk to me on video.
I might point out for the committee also that there is two provisions in our bill that addresses these problems. One is it does create a one-party consent allowance for in-custody interview in a facility. Secondly, there's a good cause exception if the defendant refuses to be recorded. So there's both protections in the bill.
Thank you.
Lieutenant, would you like to, if I'd ask Lieutenant if he could still stay on the phone just in case there's any comments, just follow up with it. Okay.
That's fine. Okay, thank you, Lieutenant, for your testimony, and I'm sure you'll be hearing from some Oregon departments in the not-too-distant future.
Okay, thank you very much, and I'll stay on the line in case there's any other questions.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Berkland.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Wendell Berkland. I'm an attorney. I come as a citizen, not representing any group. I was a prosecutor for 4 years in Multnomah County from 72 to 76, and then have done defense work from 76 until the present time. But the reason I'm here is because of this issue of potentially false confession. I think for many people that's a difficult concept to understand or really even accept, that a person would falsely confess to a horrible crime. I know it was difficult for me to believe that until 1991. I represented an individual at that time named Laverne Pavlinak. She was charged with aggravated murder, and it was co-defendant as well in that case named John Sosnowski. She was interviewed a number of times by police officers. Only the last of those interviews was recorded. It's fair to say that that last recording was very detrimental to the defense. It got her convicted for murder, got her co-defendant convicted. The problem was that many of the interviews leading up to that were not recorded. In fact, none of them were recorded. And they didn't show the interaction by police officers and investigators in providing information for her that became part of the ultimate interview. I'm not assuming that there was any wrongdoing on their part or any impropriety on their part. The point is preservation. That's what a tape recording does. I think everybody's interest in a bill like this is justice and getting the right people convicted, and certainly those people that should be acquitted released. You know, it's often said that it's better for 10 guilty people to go free than for one innocent person to be convicted. I'm not sure everyone believes that, but I can tell you, seeing a woman that was 57 years old at the time be convicted and sentenced to the penitentiary for life when we knew she was innocent was a traumatic experience for me, both professionally and personally. And the real tragedy of the whole thing, I suppose, to me, is the only way she was released was because the serial killer who had committed this act, an individual named Keith Jesperson, came forward, confessed, and led the investigators from Multnomah County to circumstantial evidence which proved his confession to be true and my client's confession to be false. And that's not going to happen every day. In fact, I've never heard of it happening before or since. You rarely have a serial killer struck with a bout of conscience, I suppose would be the word. But when I think about the case, the only way I can assume she was released was it was a miracle. You know, she and I prayed that the truth would come out. Well, ultimately it did. I just believe if all of the statements that had been given by this woman had been recorded, she wouldn't have been convicted in the first place. That would be the hope. And certainly her innocent co-defendant wouldn't have been convicted either. It was a shocking experience to go through something like that. Because as defense attorney, when you listen to a tape-recorded confession, you know, it's pretty powerful. Listening to her confession, I'll never forget what my son asked me. He listened to that tape-recorded confession and says, "Dad, what are you going to do for her?" Unfortunately, I couldn't do anything because we didn't have the other statements that had been made on tape. Had they been preserved, I don't believe she would have been convicted. That's the reason I come here today in support of this bill. I'm sure in the future, if all these recordings are made, I may wish they weren't recorded as a defense attorney. But as a citizen who's here on behalf of justice, I think it's best for all of us if they are. Thank you.
Mr. Badesar.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I too am generally a criminal defense lawyer. I've also, though, over the years, represented many other clients. I've represented crime victims. I've handled civil rights cases. And I've even actually been retained by the Oregon judiciary, the judicial department, to represent judges in various cases. I once had a case with a court of appeals judge in an original proceeding in the Supreme Court. And I've also, though, been privileged to represent many police officers over the years. I've represented police chiefs, and by the way, many of these are in officer-involved shootings, the kind of cases that Lieutenant Priest indicated was the spur for their department to start recording. But not just officer-involved shootings, which I've done for maybe 15 years, numerous cases, but also other kinds of cases, police chiefs, sergeants, lieutenants, precinct commanders, etc. And one interesting thing is that every single time that a police officer that I've represented has been interviewed, that interview has been recorded. The officers insist on it. The unions or representatives of the officers insist on it. It's just something that is done every time, which to me indicates that in many cases the police believe that a recording is necessary to preserve exactly what happened for fairness. I've been working on this recording legislation for the past several months. I was on the Senate side when that happened. And one of the things, and I've been to many of the work meetings, work committees, work groups, and one of the things that happens in these is, and you can kind of see it around the room, you'll see either the police or the DA's representatives, lobbyists, kind of looking and thinking, well, why should we be for this if the defense lawyers are for it? What's going on? What is the disconnect here? Because it's not that common of a situation. And I'd like to talk just for a second about that. And that is that there's no doubt, as Wendell said, recording is going to hurt many of our clients. We often hear, I didn't get the Miranda warnings. It says in the police report that I got them, but I didn't get Miranda warnings. I would have never talked if I got the Miranda warnings. Or we hear, the police officer says I did it or says that I was at the scene, but I never said that. And that kind of dispute is at the heart of hours and hours and hours and hours of litigation. Everybody that I've spoken to, and I spoke, for example, to an officer in Minnesota that records, they say the number of hearings that they have on either whether Miranda warnings were given or what was said during the confession, the term he used was drops off the table. It's not 10% less. It's not 20% less. It's very, very small. And there's no question that we can still have some cases that we litigated on, but the number of those cases has gotten remarkably less, and that's why the Chief Justice supports this bill. So it will hurt many of our clients, let's face it. It reduces our litigation opportunities, is one way to put it. And the best thing, though, about this kind of bill is that along with reducing that part of the litigation, it lets careful investigators on both sides, police and defense, as the case is coming to trial, as we're getting ready to figure out exactly what happened, go back and see exactly what was said. Time and again, that's what the literature says is the most important thing about this. We know no matter how good police officers are in taking notes, they sometimes don't get it right. And so we get to know exactly what the person said, something that we may not think is important, what color sweater the person had, what color the car was, whether it was day or night. Those kinds of extraneous details that sometimes are not written down can be the difference between guilt or innocence. And so while, in my view, and let me say, this is so important to the criminal defense lawyers, many of us, that we are going against the ACLU. It's my understanding that the ACLU is against the one-party consent rule. They think Oregon should be straight through two-party consent throughout. In our view, what this bill will do will help our other clients, the innocent ones. It'll help them from getting convicted, and that's why we support it. And I think it should be passed. Anybody has questions, that's fine. But it's rare, it seems to me, we spend so much time, and some of the bills will, for a better good maybe, exclude evidence, that sort of thing, take bad medicine. This is good medicine both sides. It helps protect the innocent and helps convict the guilty.
And I think Mr. Berkland kind of hit the nail on the head that striving for the better justice
right,
of
correct.
The entire thing. Is the we don't have anything else? And Lieutenant, did you want to add anything before we hang up?
No, I think that I certainly agree with the fact that what we're dealing with here is best practices, and this is about making sure that we're doing the right thing.
Okay, you may hang on for just a minute. We have a couple questions from the panel. Representative Barton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Lieutenant, can you hear me?
I can.
This is Brent Barton. I have a question for you. So I'm new to this issue, but one thing I've learned in the last several days, as I've learned about this, is I gather that this kind of recording is indeed best practices for law enforcement, and I believe actually it's already done by the Portland Police Bureau. However, I'm wondering if you think there is a distinction between police agencies following best practices versus this legislature mandating it or requiring it. And in Colorado, I gather that Denver has done it since 1983, but has a legislature in Colorado ever mandated it, or do other, for example, smaller or rural police bureaus also follow this best practice?
In Colorado, yes, they do. We have many of the police departments here in the state that utilize some type of electronic recordation, either video and or audio recordation, all of which is done so voluntarily. There is no police department within the state of Colorado that is mandated to do this. Now, I can tell you that many in law enforcement don't like being told what they need to do. But sometimes, as we all know, the way to get something started is by saying, hey, we need to do this, and whatever it is that we need to, whatever the catalyst is that starts that in that direction is probably what we ought to do. But I can tell you that we do not have a mandate here. All of our video interviewing has been done voluntarily, and we have never had anybody even bring it up to the legislature in any shape to get us mandated, simply because I don't think they see the need.
Thank you. Representative Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Hey, Lieutenant Andy Olson again.
Hello.
Anyways, a question I have, just kind of follow up from a question we had earlier this morning when I was talking to you, deals with New Jersey being one of those that's mandated right now. Can you kind of just share with us what you shared with us about the reason why that legislative body moved to mandate that with them?
I don't recall the specific case. I know I have it available, but I don't have it in front of me, so I can't cite the specific case. However, a case that occurred in New Jersey dealt with a defendant who the argument is was not properly advised of his rights, and the information that was obtained during the interview was allegedly inaccurate. And because of that, the courts basically tossed the statement, and the case was lost, and upwards this whole issue went to the state legislature, at which point they mandated that certain classes of felonies, those involving homicide, those involving sex crimes, and those involving some classes of robbery, would require video interviewing. New Jersey is a single consent state, much like Colorado is. The difference between Colorado and New Jersey is one of the things that they have put into their practice is that if a individual makes the decision that they do not want to talk on video, then New Jersey is simply obliged to denote that on the video and then shut the equipment off. They also have adopted the practice in New Jersey that they will not overtly tell anyone that they're being interviewed unless they ask. So they will most of the time just covertly do all their interrogations unless somebody asks, hey, am I being recorded? And that's the only time that we require to actually make the statement. I can tell you this, that I have done hours of training hundreds of investigators in the state of New Jersey, both local law enforcement and the state police, in the techniques of interviewing, number one, and video interviewing, number two. And a group that I saw that was very skeptical at the front end and very against doing this is now probably one of my best proponents.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a follow-up question then. And Lieutenant Priest, this is kind of a spin-off question from Representative Barton earlier when you responded back to him basically sharing that Colorado does not mandate this for the recording issue. My question to you, or actually follow-up question off of that conversation we had earlier this morning, the defense bar in Colorado was not pursued to try to mandate this as well for policy.
That's correct.
Okay. Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Okay, thank you, panel.
If I may, just to point out to the committee that similarly to what Lieutenant Priest testified to with New Jersey, we do have a refusal provision in the bill. So if the defendant refuses to be electronically recorded, it is a good cause exception. So,
Mr.
Representative Stigler.
Gail, point out specifically where the one-party exception
is.
Yeah,
it's hidden, isn't it?
Yeah, because I've read through this a few times and tried to find that. Is it?
Well,
Counsel, go ahead.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, it's in Section 3, except as otherwise provided in 133.724 to 133.726 and in the case 5.
Okay. I was looking in the wrong place.
A question to pursue in towards an interview conducted.
It doesn't come out at you very loudly, but that's it.
Section 3-1?
Okay.
Chair members, committee, it starts on page 4 on amendment to 165-540, and then it goes over to the, it creates an exception over on page 5. A person who, pursuant to Section 2 of this 2009 Act, records an interview conducted by a law enforcement agency in a law enforcement facility.
Okay, and Ms. Meyer, I want to thank you for this. Bill was kind of stumbling along, and your extra work, extra effort, and of course, Mr. Shrunk up in Portland, bring this together at the very end here as we're running out of time to get anything done. And thank you too for taking the time, Mr. Berkland, Mr. Or can I say your Mathazar, who I made many of those calls in the middle of the night on police shootings to get him out of bed to come down. Should remember that. Thank you.
Thank
you very much. Okay, Lieutenant, I'm going to go ahead and hang up portion of the testimony is over. And thank you very much for your taking the time to speak with us.
And thank you very much for allowing me. Have a good day.
Thank you. Okay, Mr. Bradley and Brian DeLeischmidt, please.
Actually, Mr. Chair, if I can go first, I can be done real very quick.
That'll always work.
For the record, Brian DeLeischmidt, representing the Oregon Council of Police Associations and the Oregon State Police Officers Association. Just wanted to let you know, I've been in situations before as bills evolve in which I've been asked later by a legislator, why didn't you come to us sooner about a concern? I want to let you know that the original version of this bill we opposed because of the new amendments that have gone through on this. We have minimized or reduced our opposition to it. I don't know whether at this point whether we're supportive, opposing, or neutral because of the time frame in which these last set of amendments have shown up. So I want to reserve the right in front of you to say, as I go back to my folks and get some feedback, I don't want to surprise anybody, but I don't know what our position is at this point. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Bradley.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, my name is John Bradley. I'm a deputy district attorney in Multnomah County. I started so long ago that your chair was a new rookie police officer, and Bill Taylor is probably still in law school.
What about Representative Barton?
He may have been born about the time I retired. I'm here to talk in favor of the bill, and I guess I'd like to start off by saying, as far as Section 1 of the bill, I would ask the committee if you kind of set that aside and not discuss it today, because there's some things that in the last 18 or 24 hours that have come up that, you know, we want to talk about and see if we can't fashion a bill that we think does what we want it to do. And I don't know that the bill before you does. You have Mike Shrunk's letter in front of you. I think it sets out his position and the position of our office. It's something that it's the 19th, so it was 2 days ago. And this is where our office has really become involved. Maybe we should have become involved sooner. Unfortunately, in the last 2 days. So when they talk about these amendments coming up, those are primarily our amendments. And what I'd like to talk to you about is sort of Multnomah County, and I realize we're a large county, and I'd also like to talk just a bit about how we got these amendments. 2 days ago, Mike Shrunk came in and asked me to look at this bill. He said he supported the concept of recordation, but he wanted to make sure that we were satisfied that it wasn't going to do something that nobody intended it to do. So the first thing I did is I went among the senior deputies in our office, and I think there's probably only one of you here who would know them, but it was Don Reese, Chuck Sparks, Pat Callahan, Amy Holmes-Hain, and several others who have broad experience throughout our office. I mean, I haven't tried a case for 2 years or maybe 3 years. I used to try cases all the time, but it was some time ago. And I wanted to talk to people in our office who are in trial every day prosecuting criminal cases. And we gave them the original bill and we said, you know, are there things in this bill that you don't like? You know, are there ways that we can change this that you'd be satisfied? And I don't think anybody was against recordation. They wanted to make sure that they felt satisfied that they weren't going to get hosed someplace. So they gave me a list of concerns that they had, and with the exception of one, I think I put them all in, and I think you have almost all of those. There was one that Gail Meyer and I talked about, and she talked me out of it that we really didn't need it. And the other one was something that was just, I thought, sort of ridiculous, and I didn't think, I didn't want to bother anybody by it. It was on the jury instruction. And so what the amendments you have in front of you and the bill you have from it is really from the Multnomah County District Attorney's Office. And we have had experience in recordation of defendants. We have experience in recordation and experience in non-recordation, because we have the Portland Police Bureau that for the Measure 11 offenses primarily do record the defendants. We have the Gresham Police Department that, this isn't my knowledge, this is the knowledge I gained from talking to other members of our staff, who don't record things very often. And they just said the difference between the two, it's substantial, and that this is something we just need to learn. Now, one of the questions that Representative Olson, or no, it's Representative Barton said is, or it was one of the two of you, said, should we be mandating this?
Mr. Chair, we get confused often.
Well, I have bad eyes. Maybe you shouldn't mandate it. But on the other hand, I think you're not mandating it with something in which you're saying we're going to suppress this evidence. You're not mandating by something saying you're going to dismiss it. You're just saying this is something we ought to do. And quite frankly, from our office's standpoint, it gives us a little, you know, it gives us a little bit of, I don't want to say power, but, you know, where we can go to a police department that's not doing it and say, you got to do it because it's the law. Let's do it. And Portland Police Bureau, we've never had that problem, but sometimes police bureaus, and you can talk to all the district attorneys, they're all different. I mean, we deal with, in our county, we have the Portland Police Bureau, we have Gresham, we've got the Sheriff's Office, we've got Troutdale, we've got Gresham, and the Oregon State Police, and I think Fairview. So you're dealing with a lot of different police agencies, and this is something that we'd like our cases to be consistent. And I think at the end of the day that this is going to be better for us than not doing it, although I realize there are other people that are probably a lot better than I am who believe otherwise. But within our office, I think the consensus, in fact, is I don't know anybody who said otherwise, is that this will be better for us. One thing I want to put on the record to make this clear is from what has been drafted, this does not require the recordation in a police car or a vehicle or a bus. I only say that, I want to make that legislative history. I think that's, if Ms. Myers, that is correct, isn't it? Because people just want to make sure that this is not something that turns out to be a car and they didn't know about it. And the other thing is, again, Ms. Myers said this, is that operator error, where somebody thinks they're recording, is should not be grounds for it. Because we do have today, probably every one of us, well, maybe not everybody, but almost every one of us has a tape recorder on you. Because I thought about this. Today, as I came down here, I have my telephone. And on my telephone, I can look, and I can hook it up, and I can record this proceeding. And then I can pull out my little card, and I can put it on my computer. And the other thing is, I listen to books on tape when I travel. I have a little MP3 player. This MP3 player also has a tape recorder on it. So, I just don't think it's that difficult. I mean, I could come in, I could be a police officer, and if I was afraid somebody would, you know, stop talking if there was a tape recorder, I could walk in with my telephone, put it down and be recording, advise them of their rights. They wouldn't have a clue. In Portland, we have rooms in which people go in and, you know, things are recorded. But I do think it's important that we are going to get cases, and I can't tell you that I haven't done this with a tape recorder, where I turned it on totally expecting that it was working, and when we were done, it wasn't. And one of the amendments we just say is that that type of human error will not result in a penalty under this statute. And I guess, one final thing is, Gail has been very, very good on this, except I think there's one thing we disagree on. I think what I asked her, and I may not have, but I said,
we only should have recorded it.
And we know. That's a very good point. What I suggested to her was this. I said, let's draft two amendments for when this becomes effective. One would be, I believe as the current bill says, starting on January 1 of next year, it would be the it'd be murder case or homicide cases, Measure 11 cases for juveniles and for non-speaking, or where people needed an interpreter. And then a year later, it would be for everybody for Measure 11 cases or homicide cases. Then I said, would you draft also include something and say, let's just do it all at one time. Just let's put an amendment and say, let's start July 1, 2010. I've talked to members of the District Attorney's Association. They would prefer that it be a two-step process. And the reason is, and I think it's certainly a legitimate concern, is just to get people ready for it, to try it out, to find out where the bugs are going to be, and then start in July 1, 2011.
We did have that discussion. Thank you, Mr. Bradley, if I might interject. The original bill that came over from the Senate was a two-faced bill. And it does say that January 1, 2010, the bill would apply to homicides, minors, non-native speakers requiring an interpreter or translator. And then second phase of the bill would be July 1, 2011 for full implementation. So, yes, and I misunderstood you. But Mr. Bradley and I were thinking of having two different bills, and then I thought you and I both decided we liked the simplicity of the one collapsed phase. But I'm hearing you say that members of your office now like the two phases.
Well, what I said is I wanted to talk okay. to other people
okay.
before doing that, because it's one thing for a large county to do something, and it might be completely different for a smaller county to do something. And I have two other things I'd like to say. One, I'd like to say, when this bill first came up and when I first heard the idea of recordations, I probably had the same reactions that most prosecutors have. Nobody will talk. You know, people aren't going to talk to you. They're going to stop. We're going to lose confessions and things like that. I don't think that's been the experience. I think when you put a tape recorder in front of somebody, my gut tells me that they're not likely, it is likely to talk to you as. But on the other hand, I don't have that experience. So, you know, I simply don't know that. But the fact that that was, you know, we have the one party, the fact that I think everything's been taken care of in here to see now, you know, can we get to getting our confessions and our statements recorded? And the last thing I'd like to say is I just want to put this on the record, is your chair one time saved my life, and I'm not going to say why. If there are any questions.
That was before I was a cop and he was a deputy district attorney. Representative Barton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Regarding Section 1.
Yes.
No, I understand that apparently the parties would like to tinker with it a bit more, and I respect that. I feel put everyone on notice that that regardless of whether consensus is reached or otherwise, I don't, speaking for myself anyway, I suspect more than a few others, I don't know that to the extent we tinker with the hearsay rule, I don't know that this committee can be expected reasonably to just rubber stamp consensus or otherwise, and such that even if we choose to put discussion of that aside and focus on recordation today, we're running out of time, and that is something that to the extent parties choose to do so, they do so at their peril. I, for one, actually have a number of questions on that. I can discuss it later or today or at any other time. And I would also, I understand that I would appreciate a copy of the underlying court decision it's actually designed to address.
I'm sorry?
Somebody. It's my understanding that Section 1 in this bill
is designed to address an Oregon Supreme Court decision.
It's State versus Rodriguez. Okay. And just for the record, it's reported at 345 Oregon 39.
It's a one-way state.
One more time, please.
345 Oregon 39.
39. Yes. Thank you.
Chair. Representative Garrett. I'm sorry, I've gotten myself all confused, but this would allow recording without the defendant's consent, correct?
That is correct.
So what possible basis could there be for a concern that a defendant won't talk if we can record without consent? I know you're not taking that position.
No, I'm not. I've been a prosecutor for a long, long time, and I know it seems to me that when I've asked some people could I tape record you, some people have just said no, that I couldn't. And I'm not a police officer. I'm talking to people who are perhaps witnesses, but over the years, that feeling could be wrong. And so what I think I was trying to say is that when the bill first came out, and there was not just where both people had to agree and you had to inform the person, at that point, my gut reaction was, whether or not it's right or wrong, I don't know, was that's not a good idea. That's all I was trying to say. Okay.
Mr. Chair, if I may address that. Again, Brian DeLeishmet, Representative Garrett. Actually, that provision was put in because of some concerns from police officers themselves. When they were informed that this was what occurred in many other states as far as the recordation, they did some investigations and found out that in nearly all, if not all, of the states that had a provision in statute, it was one-party consent. And so they made contacts with the officers in those other states. Came back with that information and said this would ease some of our concern if there was one-party recordation consent. They did express concerns as detectives that they had some reservations about putting a microphone in front of somebody and whether or not they would continue the conversation. They also, just to be a little clearer, as we've evolved in this bill, it was different crimes, and all of a sudden certain crimes, not property crimes, it was person crimes, then it's been Measure 11. The officers were concerned about starting down a path in which it may be a property crime, and then all of a sudden having to go, whoa, wait a minute, we've now gotten into an area where it might be a person crime, I have to get my recorder out, let's continue our conversation and lay it in front of the person. So that's the evolution of that.
And additionally, there was some concern as regarding jury instruction and so on, if it wasn't recorded, and that was part of the discussion about, well, what if somebody refused and so on. Ms. Meyer.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Garrett. The other thing is that not all agencies have a facility for surreptitious recording. So you need to do both. There are the smaller agencies that would have to use a handheld machine, and if there's a refusal then they would be excused.
Thank you. Any further questions for the panel?
What I wanted to be really clear on was, because sometimes if you read this, there might be a little bit of a contradiction between the exception that allows a good cause showing for a refusal to record, yet we've done the exception to the two-party consent requirement on the face-to-face thing. So I just want to make sure we're not setting ourselves up for some kind of a little glitch here where, on one hand we're providing some kind of a excuse, but on the other hand we're also providing a backdoor way for somebody to challenge.
If I could just address that for a second. One of the things that a number of the deputies in our office talked about when you're talking about the refusal and why that part of the reason why that language is there, realize anytime you have a statute, there are a lot of situations you don't think about. One of the situations would be if all of a sudden you were having a proffer with a criminal defendant, and a proffer is where somebody wants to come in and talk and say, hey, I've got information on X, Y, and Z. In a situation like that, you might, whether or not you have to Mirandize people, you don't know, but certainly the person wouldn't want it recorded. And I'm just saying that several people in our office said that, and I think the fact that when somebody doesn't want it recorded, that it doesn't get recorded.
Well, Mr. Chair, follow up. I don't have a problem with that. I just want to be very clear that one doesn't set the other up for some kind of a problem trying to think of both sides of this issue somewhere down the road and end up putting the prosecution, quite frankly, in a bad spot because it was or it wasn't. And if it isn't, then, I mean, there's almost, conceptually, they're almost contradictory in and of themselves. So,
Chair Barker and Representative Stiegler, in a way, they do look that way, and they didn't happen simultaneously. So as originally drafted, we had the refusal language in there.
Right.
Then when we added later the one-party consent, I thought to myself, well, maybe we should take out the refusal. But at the suggestion of some law enforcement agencies, they said, no, we could see tapping
that, sure.
in. So it is intended that regardless of one-party consent, if the defendant expressly refuses to be recorded, that can be honored. That's good cause.
Mr. Chair, if I may just add one additional thing. I neglected when I was up here before kind of doing my disclaimer that I have had conversations with Kevin Campbell and John Powell on behalf of their associations, and they're in the same situation as I am with the late amendments that just came in that I got at 11:07 last night. They haven't had time to check either, so I think they would claim the same immunity as I would at this point and not knowing what our position is.
Okay, thank you. Representative Shields.
Mr. Chair, I just wanted to thank you and the Multnomah County District Attorney's Office for putting so much work into this, and of course OCDLA. I think in my district, there, regardless of the reality, there's certainly a perception that the criminal justice system could be fairer, and anything that we can do to address people's concerns puts us on a path to having people cooperate more with law enforcement. I think the benefits are very broad and wide-ranging, and I just want to thank you for bringing this forward and coming up with what seems like a very incredible amount of work to get a compromise that everybody could live with.
And I just would add one other thing, that I've had people without recordation say, I'm refusing to talk, which is perfectly all right as well, within their rights. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
And I'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 309 and reopen the work session on Senate Bill 373 for the purpose of Representative Krieger being allowed to vote. Representative Krieger, how do you vote?
Aye.
Representative Krieger votes aye. Thank you. No further business before the committee. Committee adjourns.